Even though it's day 11 of the government shutdown, the Supreme Court will resume next week as scheduled. And the first case they're hearing could allow wealthy donors to spend even more money on political campaigns. The case could also endanger state limits on money in politics. We'll talk about media coverage with the Huffington Post's Paul Blumenthal and the Nation's Lee Fang. Independent journalist Ishmael Kushkush will join us from Khartoum, Sudan, to discuss coverage of the deadly protests that have erupted in the wake of discontent with the government and the doubling of gas prices. Reporters Without Borders ranks Sudan as the worst in press freedoms. So what challenges do reporters face? Join us after the news.
News with Marion Marshall. The winner of this year's Nobel Peace Prize, the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, says the award will spur it on to even greater efforts. The organization's head, Ahmet Uzumcu, said the recent poison gas attack in Syria was a tragic reminder of how much still remained to be done.
Today, we are engaged in work which is meant to ensure that this atrocity is not repeated. Never in the history of our organization have we been called on to verify a destruction program within such short time frames and in an ongoing conflict. We are conscious of the enormous trust that the international community has bestowed on us.
For its part, the Nobel Committee urged Russia and America to meet their commitments and destroy their own chemical weapons. The convicted Nazi war criminal Erich Priebke has died in Italy. The 100-year-old former SS officer had been living under house arrest in Rome after being convicted in the late 1990s of involvement in the massacre of more than 300 Italian civilians in 1944. Priebke was extradited to Italy after decades of living in Argentina. He expressed no regret for his crime, saying he was only following orders.
Yes, I was there, but that was a thing that was ordered by our command. At that time, order was an order, you see.
And you carried it out?
Yeah, I had to carry it out, yes.
And civilians died?
Civilians died, yes. Many civilians died. On all parts in the world, still they are dying.
The International Criminal Court has accepted a Libyan demand that Colonel Gaddafi's former military intelligence chief, Abdullah Al-Senussi, should be tried in Libya rather than The Hague. It's the first time a country has succeeded in convincing judges in The Hague that it's willing and able to conduct such a trial on home soil. The court said, however, that the Libyan authorities had not so far satisfied its criteria for trying Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam. He's been held in the southern town of Zintan by a militia that's refusing to transfer him to Tripoli for trial. The three main political parties in Britain have reached agreement on a new system of press regulation in the wake of the phone hacking scandal. Our political correspondent Rob Watson has the details.
The broad outlines of the deal have been well known for some time. A new regulator to be created by the newspaper industry, but with oversight from a body set up by Royal Charter. There are concessions to the press in the new deal. People and organisations, for example, will have to pay a fee to make certain complaints about coverage. Certainly, this is what's been described as a moment of truth for the newspaper industry. It strongly dislikes the idea of a parliamentary-backed system of regulation. But does it feel it can simply walk away from it?
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. President Obama is holding talks with Republican senators in a further effort to resolve the budget deadlock that's caused a partial government shutdown. Reports say the Republicans have offered a new deal to end the standoff. In talks late on Thursday, senior Republicans were looking at a plan to give Mr. Obama a short-term debt limit increase, staving off the threat of default, in return for further negotiations. Public opinion polls have shown a sizable majority of Americans blame the Republicans for the crisis. At least 12 migrants have drowned and more than 100 have been rescued after their boat, heading for Europe, capsized off the coast of Alexandria in northern Egypt. From Cairo, here's Jim Muir.
The survivors from this latest disaster, mainly Syrians and Palestinians, were rescued by the Egyptian Coast Guard, who were continuing the search. The boat sank in the early morning. It's not known why. But it's the latest in a series of similar accidents afflicting desperate refugees or economic migrants trying to get to Europe illegally, mainly through Italy. Those leaving from Alexandria in northern Egypt are almost all Syrians or Palestinian refugees who are resident in Syria and fled the war there.
And reports are just coming in of another boat carrying migrants that has capsized, this time between Sicily and Tunisia. Italian officials say an estimated 200 people are in the water and rescue efforts are underway. The authorities in Mozambique have expelled a Portuguese football coach for insulting the country. Diamantino Miranda, who managed the Costa do Sol club in the capital Maputo, was recorded as saying that Mozambicans were, in his words, a bunch of thieves, after he disagreed with a refereeing decision. In a tearful and emotional speech at a press conference, he apologised, adding that he held Mozambican people close to his heart. He's been told to leave the country by Saturday. Costa do Sol is one of the biggest teams in the country. BBC News.
Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Next Tuesday, the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in McCutcheon v. Federal Election Commission. The case challenges the two-year contribution limit for individual campaign donors, which currently stands at $123,200 per donor for the 2014 election cycle. According to today's guests, this case could open the door for even more money to pour into political campaigns and parties. Joining us to discuss media coverage is Lee Fang, a reporter fellow at The Nation, where he covers money in politics, conservative movements, and lobbying. He's the author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. Hey, Lee, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rose. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Paul Blumenthal. He's a reporter with The Huffington Post, covering money and influence in politics. He previously worked as a senior writer for the Sunlight Foundation, covering lobbying and transparency issues. Hi, Paul. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Nice to have you. And we're also discussing media coverage of the deadly protests in Sudan. According to Reporters Without Borders' 2013 World Press Freedom Index, Sudan ranks among the worst in press freedoms. According to Amnesty International, 210 people have been killed in Khartoum, mostly due to gunshot wounds to the chest and head, and at least 800 have been arrested. Demonstrations began after the government lifted subsidies on gasoline, which nearly doubled the price of fuel overnight. Ishmael Kushkush is a freelance journalist working with the New York Times and CNN, and he's been covering this extensively. And he joins us from Khartoum. Hi, Ishmael. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Hi, nice to have you. So as we always do on Friday, we start off on a positive note and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So Lee, why don't we start off with you? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
My favorite piece was an article in the New York Times on Monday by Cheryl Gay Stolberg about the conservative groups that have planned the government shutdown all year. Freedom Works, many of the other organizations that have been very visible in past debates, like the Tea Party, worked since February in developing a resolution, pressuring lawmakers, doing the grassroots advocacy and airing ads, promoting Ted Cruz, and really laying the groundwork to where we are today in Washington. And it was a refreshing piece because I think too much of the coverage in D.C. has focused on the process-type stories and the supposed ideology, where here was a really substantive investigative article laying bare some of the players driving the movement.
Can you talk about some of the money behind this and just how much influence they have on these groups have on politicians?
Sure. The Conservative Action Project is an ad hoc coalition. It was mentioned in the article as a low-profile group. Well, they've existed since 2009, and they've received a lot of funding and financial support from the Heritage Foundation and from a very secretive group of evangelicals called the Council for National Policy. They've provided some direct funding to this ad hoc coalition. But remember, this coalition is made up of about 15 or 16 different conservative organizations, many of them associated with the Christian right, like the Family Research Council. A lot of these organizations are 501(c)s that don't disclose their donors. That being said, we do know that several very ideological billionaires, like the DeVos family in Michigan, have provided substantial funding for these organizations. But again, we don't know the exact money trail, but it goes back to several of the billionaires who have at least historically worked with the Koch brothers and others to push the country in a more conservative direction.
And according to this New York Times piece, the billionaire Koch brothers, Charles and David, have been deeply involved with financing the overall effort. A group linked to the Koch's Freedom Partners Chamber of Commerce, I've never heard of that one, dispersed more than $200 million last year to nonprofits involved in this fight. Lee, I mean, this government shutdown is still getting 24/7 coverage, but how many outlets are actually focusing on what's going on behind the scenes and all of these groups that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars?
Well, before I came on the show today, I was watching CNN, and a lot of these media outlets are focusing on the stated demands of Republicans, which shift every day. If you look, though, between the lines, what these organizations that are driving the shutdown are demanding are a list of policy writers. They say, okay, well, if you're going to make a deal, let's attach some unrelated policy demands. So they've asked for repealing the medical device tax, which is a $1 billion giveaway to Medtronic and all these other companies. They've asked for approving the Keystone XL pipeline. they're using this kind of contrived crisis, if you will, to get as many giveaways to their corporate and millionaire benefactors. So I think that's the kind of interesting backstory to all of this. And at the end of the day, whatever the policy solution is, it's looking like it'll benefit a very small number of well-heeled interest groups.
Mm. Well, let's talk about that later in the show, because we're going to talk about the Supreme Court case that's going to be heard on Tuesday, which could allow wealthy donors to spend even more on political campaigns, which is kind of hard to believe since we just had a $1 billion presidential campaign. But thank you. This piece is really long, and we'll link to it right after the show. And what about you, Paul? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
I mean, I guess, you know, first of all, I just like to say all of the work that my colleagues at the Huffington Post have been doing covering, you know, the actual human effect of this government shutdown on, you know, lower-income people, middle-income people, small businesses, families who want to send their kids to Head Start, who, you know, now have to rely on private charitable donations to cover their children's, you know, education for a month. And then they have to see what's going to happen at the end of this month, if they're going to be able to have Head Start or have to seek another $10 million donation. At the same time, I also saw, you know, a really good article from John Judis at the New Republic today, sort of going over and talking to a lot of the Republican leaders from the past 20 years who sort of reject this shutdown strategy and built a more, you know, right wing, but, you know, they call it center right form of governance that has sort of cracked up in this era of Obama being president, and sort of discussing the history of the, you know, radical middle class populism that we see in the Tea Party and what that means for you know, the Republican Party in the future. And, Judas basically makes the conclusion that, you know, we could be seeing a slow motion demise of a political party in a modern era.
How would that happen? I mean, a lot of the Tea Partiers are in very safe districts that are overwhelmingly conservative and white. So how would that happen?
Well, I mean, I think that what you look at it is not just, you know, elected representatives. And as I said, you know, not necessarily fast motion in the 2014 elections or anything like that. But, you know, these kind of actions really turn off a lot of Americans. And I think that you start to see that manifesting in polls. And, you know, you could wind up see it manifesting in the kind of money that goes to these congressmen and senators and political parties from people who don't really want to see the government shut down every 6 months or see the debt limit held hostage every couple of months. And eventually, you know, you could have people break away from the Republican Party and certain elements like the Tea Party. You have, you know, the head of Red State, the right-wing blog, Eric Erickson, who said that, you know, maybe it's time to form a new conservative party outside of the Republican Party. And I mean, it seems that there's an internal fissure which in that political party that is sort of driving this this shutdown, which Lee alluded to, that there's money behind that fissure.
Right. And just quickly, because you brought up just how the shutdown is affecting, you know, average people, because the poor don't have lobbyists. I mean, the parks are getting actually a lot of attention, and I'm glad they are. But I think the parks are getting more attention than the poor. So national parks. So can you talk a little bit about how the shutdown is affecting the poor?
Well, I mean, you know, there's dozens of programs that work to aid regular people every day. I mean, whether it's, you know, in North Carolina, they're giving baby formula through WIC to, people on food stamps. I mean, this is a serious issue for people with families. You know, you have you had the cuts to Head Start, which basically stopped, but now has been filled in the gaps. You had cuts to veterans' families. A lot of them are middle or lower income. Congress is trying to fill that because veterans have a much bigger voice than ordinary lower income people. You don't see the, you know, poor people super PAC out there spending $10 million on ads to get their voice out. There was a ad campaign launched, I believe, just today by a labor union to go after some Republican congressmen over the shutdown to try to pressure them to end this. So, I mean, you know, that's the only voice out there really for middle and lower income people is labor unions.
And in just 21 days, according to the documentary A Place at the Table, the 48 million people who are on food stamps are going to see their monthly check be cut. And right now it's about $4 a day on average. So they're actually going to see a cut in about a month.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's a huge impact on people, you know, living at the margins and trying to get by and feed their family.
All right. So thank you for those stories. And we'll put links right after the show. And what about you, Ishmael? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
There was a good article this morning in the Guardian about the protests in Sudan. I think if no one has read anything about the protests, this is just one good comprehensive article that goes into the economic reasons for these protests, the lifting of gasoline subsidies, the class factor in these protests, how middle class, the upper classes, and the average Sudanese were all part of this protest movement, the various opposition movements, the youth groups, the political opposition, the division within the ruling party, and the prospects of this protest movement going on forward. The protests have slowed down a little bit, and it goes into the reasons why the protests have slowed down, because of an upcoming Muslim holiday and because of the lack of leadership in the protest movement. I think this was just one very good comprehensive article that Patrick Kingsley flew in from Cairo, did a very good job. I think if anyone wants to read just one article on the youth protest, I think this is the article to read.
Okay, great. Thank you. And this is Ishmael Kushkush. He's a freelance journalist working with The New York Times and CNN. He's joining us from Khartoum, Sudan, and he'll be on the line for about 15 or so more minutes. So if you'd like to talk about what's happening in Sudan, if you have any questions about the protests there, they've been deadly. According to Amnesty International, 210 people have been killed, mostly due to gunshot wounds to the chest and head. 800 have been arrested. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Ishmael, because Sudan really doesn't get talked about in the United States, Reporters Without Borders came out with a new survey that found Sudan ranks among the worst in press freedoms. And I understand that at any given time, there are about four permanent residing English-speaking journalists in Sudan. So can you talk about just the challenges that you face in trying to get this story out?
As you mentioned, there are only four permanent residing English-speaking journalists, myself, Reuters, AFP, and Al Jazeera English. Usually what happens is that journalists from regional hubs like Nairobi or Cairo fly in. But, you know, given the events in Egypt today and the events that were taking place in Nairobi at the Westgate Mall, you did not have the number of journalists coming in, flying in from those two big cities. So a lot depended on the journalists that were here. Four journalists covering Sudan for an English-speaking crowd is just not enough. Sudan is a big country. It is difficult to cover. You need permits to travel to outside of Khartoum, to Darfur, to South Kordofan, to Blue Nile. And usually it is difficult to get those permits. The authorities are not keen on having journalists fly into those areas. So reporting generally in Sudan is very difficult. And you have a very complicated political scene here. You know, almost every political party is divided into three or five factions, various ethnic groups. Most of the reporters that come don't speak Arabic. So I think this is one of the reasons why we don't get enough coverage, at least out to the English-speaking world.
And you report that inside the country, newspapers have been shut down, television stations have been shut down. So what is the situation like for local journalists?
Well, for local journalists, I think it's even much more difficult. During these protests, seven papers were either suspended temporarily or on their own chose not to publish because their journalists could not cover the protest. Three newspapers on their own decided that they would not publish because they would not be able to cover the protest. Now the papers are back, but it definitely shows that they have not been able to cover the main news of the past 3 weeks and those were the protests. There's a lot of pressure on these papers. Usually what happens in the evening, there's security checks on what is being published, and if authorities don't like what they see, the papers are suspended or that edition of the newspaper is confiscated. The two Arab satellite TV stations, Al Arabiya and Sky News Arabia, were also suspended from work in Sudan until further notice. So, you know, these past few weeks saw a heavy crackdown on the media here in Sudan.
And what sparked these protests? You write that young people took to the streets saying the people want to bring down the regime. They talked about revolution. So what really sparked these protests, and what are people saying on the streets?
Well, the main spark was the lifting of subsidies on gasoline. The price of gasoline basically doubled in price, and with that, almost every commodity in the market doubled with that. But of course, there are a number of grievances and accumulation over several years, you know, the lack of freedoms, the wars in the different parts of the countries. There were attempts for protest in 2011 that failed. Last year and this year was just a continuation of those attempts. People want to see better government. They want to see more freedoms. They want to see a more democratic system. And they want to see a better running of the economic system. Since South Sudan's separation, the economy of Sudan has been facing many challenges since Sudan lost 75% of the oil revenues that it once enjoyed. The value of the Sudanese pound has plummeted. When I first arrived 7 years ago, one U.S. dollar equaled £2. In the black market today, one U.S. dollar equals about £8. So the economy has just been suffering, and people are not able to live. They want to see better governance.
Well, we have a few callers on the line with questions about Sudan, so let's hear from Oscar in Virginia. Hi, Oscar. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Yes, I wanted to ask Ismail just quickly. I know that there's been reporting on the protests and the violence in Khartoum and the neighboring city of Omdurman, but I was wondering what's going on outside of the central area, places like Red Sea State or Kordofan or some of the other states that are not in the central capital area.
Ishmael, did you hear Oscar?
Yes, I heard the question.
Okay,
yes.
Go ahead.
The protest actually first started in the central Sudanese city of Wad Madani in Gezira State, about 200 kilometers south from here. Those protests were on for 2 days before the protest started here in the capital. Now, we hear a protest in parts of Kordofan, in Darfur, in the city of Niala, and also in Sinnar State, in the city of Sinnar, and in the east in Port Sudan. From my understanding is that the protests were smaller than a number than here in Khartoum. But of course, most of the tension was here in Khartoum. The number of deaths were larger, the protests were bigger. And again, as I was mentioning, Sudan is a big country. You need more. Each agency needs at least two reporters to do a good coverage of Sudan, and that's just not happening at the moment.
All right, thanks for the call, Oscar. Let's go next to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Question about the underlying reasons, but I wanted to know how people in northern Sudan are viewing southern Sudan and the other secession movements, the other problems, if that also has any relationship to the raise in the oil price, and also how do they view what's going on in Egypt and Syria? What are the people in the streets saying about that?
What is happening around Sudan has shaped how many Sudanese view the possibility of an uprising and revolution here in Sudan. People are worried about a Syria-like scenario. Sudan has a very complicated ethnic makeup. There are various political forces. Weapons are widespread. I think this is one of the main reasons why the first two attempts to create an uprising in 2011 and 2012 did not succeed, because the average Sudanese was very worried that Sudan would turn into Syria or even Egypt or Libya during its revolution. I think that feeling is starting to fade away because of the great number of people killed in Khartoum these past 3 weeks, but still that is weighing heavily on the minds of many Sudanese. Understood the question correctly, the impact of the rebellions in the other parts of the country. I think this is also one of the reasons why we haven't seen an uprising in Khartoum. People are worried what rebel movements in other parts of the country, how they would react to an uprising here in Khartoum. And that is something that the government has been quite able to manipulate to its own benefit. The average Sudanese, at least in the center, is with great concern about what rebel movements coming in from the other parts of the country might do if they were to assume power. From my understanding is that a statement was made by the SRF, the Sudanese Rebellion Front, that it would show solidarity with the uprising or the protest movements here in the capital. But I think still there are many who are worried about what might happen if rebels come into the capital.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Harry. And Lee and Paul, before we let Ishmael go, do you have any questions for him? I know you both don't. This is completely out of your radar, but is this something you read about? Or I mean, it's interesting to think that you both cover a very specific issue in the U.S. government, and Ishmael has to cover the entire Sudan. I mean, there are only four reporters there at any given time.
Well, I'm very ashamed to say I haven't been following this news as closely, and largely because I've been kind of obsessed with the government shutdown and the politics that underlie it. But I'd just like to ask Ishmael, how's the American media covered it? Would he critique the Western press and just the way they've portrayed it in the news? I'd like to hear his perspective.
I think this time around there's been better coverage. There were a number of reporters that flew in from Cairo, and I believe a number of reporters are on their way from Nairobi. I think AP actually did some good coverage here on the ground. I mean, I think one of the problems is that, you know, covering Sudan from Cairo and Nairobi can give you a good, accurate picture, but having at least those journalists come in, I mean, adding to what the journalists that are here permanently are doing, I think does a good job. And I think AP did some good work also. The Washington Post and The Economist actually had some very good articles. So I think this time around we've seen better reporting, but still not as adequate as we'd like to see.
And could I ask one quick follow-up? What about the role of American NGOs? You know, actually, the last Sudan story about Sudan I read was a couple weeks ago, but it was about George Clooney, the American actor who's associated with the Enough Project, this genocide kind of accountability organization in Washington, D.C., and, you know, he had provided funds for satellites to monitor Sudan to kind of provide an early warning system if there was some type of military action. I'm curious, what's been the role of American NGOs in this current kind of crisis?
That is a great question. We have to take a quick break, and we'll get Ishmael's response right after this.
All the stories that you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable will be posted at yourcallradio.org. And we invite you to highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email, question, or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Like our elders and our teachers, even though we have been the peaceful ones, you send your secret servants to terrorize our town. It's our street, it's our home, it's our land, it's our blood, it's our time to rise above your crumbling ground. System down, system down. Our voices found.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll talk about what we want from online comment sections on news and information sites. YouTube is imposing stricter moderation. The Huffington Post has banned anonymous comments, and Popular Science has dropped commenting altogether. So where do we draw the line between moderation and censorship? That's on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it is our media roundtable, and we are discussing coverage of the deadly protests in Sudan. Sudan ranks among the worst in press freedoms, according to Reporters Without Borders. And we're joined by Ishmael Kushkush. He's a freelance journalist. He's been extensively covering the protests for the New York Times. He joins us from Khartoum. We're also joined by Lee Fang, a reporting fellow at The Nation, and Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with The Huffington Post. In just a couple minutes, we'll be talking with them about the Supreme Court's hearing next week that could allow wealthy donors to spend even more money on political campaigns. But before we do that, Ishmael, Lee Fang had a question about NGOs in Sudan.
Right. I mean, it's like the Centennial Project that are run by actor George Clooney. Those satellites usually monitor the movements of the Sudanese military along the Sudan-South Sudan border or movements within war zones like South Kordofan State and Blue Nile. I haven't seen much involvement in these current protests, but there have been a number of, like I said, journalists covering the protests here on the ground here in the capital, Khartoum. AP, Al Jazeera English, AFP, myself, and of course, a number of Arabic satellite TVs like Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya and Sky News Arabia and others. But no direct involvement from any U.S. NGOs that I've seen.
And does someone like George Clooney getting involved in Sudan, does that help the people at all? I mean, what do the locals think about that?
People have different opinions, I think, about that. And it depends on where you are, what part of the country, and what your political opinion is. There are those, I think, in those war zones that see the involvement of Clooney as helpful to the cause, but there are also those here in the capital or other parts that are not see that it might oversimplify the issues that depoliticizes it, or it focuses on one aspect or one incident. There's different opinions on that.
All right. Well, Ishmael, thank you so much for staying up late and joining us.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you. That is Ishmael Kushkush. He's a freelance journalist working with the New York Times and CNN, covering the deadly protests in Sudan. Sudan ranks among the worst in press freedoms. At any given time, there are just 4 permanent residing English-speaking journalists there. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. And staying with us for the rest of the hour is Li Feng, a reporting fellow at The Nation, where he covers money in politics, conservative movements, and lobbying. He's the author of the book, The Machine, A Field Guide to the Resurgent Right. It's about how the right-wing political infrastructure was rebuilt after the 2008 election. We're also joined by Paul Blumenthal, a reporter with The Huffington Post, where he also covers money and politics. And they've both been writing about this case that's going to be heard on Tuesday. The Supreme Court, despite the government shutdown, will continue as scheduled. And Lee, it's kind of hard to believe that, depending on how the Supreme Court comes down, even more money could be spent on political campaigns. First off, talk about this case, McCutcheon versus Federal Election Commission. Who is Sean McCutcheon, the man bringing the case?
Sean McCutcheon is a businessman in Alabama, and he was joined by the Republican National Committee in pushing forward with this case. He's an individual who would like to donate above the FEC's aggregate contribution cap, and that aggregate contribution cap basically says that individuals can only give a certain amount. I believe now it's around $120,000 to different political committees, in addition to political parties, every two-year cycle. And the purpose of this cap is to prevent individuals from exploiting the system. So you could have an individual who gives the maximum amount to a single committee, but then without an aggregate cap, they could give to dozens, if not hundreds, of dummy political action committees that could be bundled into one huge number. So the aggregate cap prevents a single person from basically gaming the system. But it in his case, in bringing it to the court, some of the legal issues that are being debated really center on the constitutionality of caps in general. So the case has evolved into something that just kind of focuses on, should we have caps on any of these campaign committees? Because right now, in the post-Citizens United campaign finance world, independent expenditures, these supposedly outside groups that can't coordinate with candidates, they can receive unlimited contributions. But when it comes to a donor approaching a candidate and giving directly to their committee, we still have caps. And that's the kind of the last frontier.
And Paul, Sean McCutcheon owns Coalmont Electrical Development Company in Alabama. You report that in recent years, he's increased his political involvement with the Alabama Republican Party. And his main argument is that the limits are an unconstitutional burden on his First Amendment rights of free speech and of association. So how did he manage to get this case to the Supreme Court?
Okay, so, well, first of all, I just want to correct something that we're talking about here, which is that the court case was actually heard this Tuesday by the Supreme Court, which I attended. So, you know, we could talk about what the court actually already talked about. But what how Sean McCutcheon got this case to the court is, you know, he had been going over all of his contributions. He wanted to make another contribution and was looking at this chart that the Alabama Republican Party gave him. And he noticed, well, I can't give that contribution based on these limits. And, you know, he was here in Washington at one of these conservative voter events and met up with a lawyer that he had worked with named Dan Backer, who has spent a lot of time and a lot of money filing these court cases to try to undermine campaign finance laws in general. And, you know, Dan Backer is part of this whole movement of conservative lawyers who try to find the perfect case to take to the Supreme Court to undercut campaign finance laws. So Dan Backer said, hey, this sounds like a great case. Let's take it to the Supreme Court. Sean McCutcheon says, I don't believe you, but fine. And, you know, then they wound up going all the way to the Supreme Court where, you know, it looks like the justices will, you know, strike down at least one of these aggregate limits, of which there are about three.
Okay, so that was my fault because I read your story on the 8th, which is Tuesday, and it said on Tuesday the Supreme Court will hear oral arguments, but it was actually posted on the 7th, updated on the 8th. So I just missed the date. So thank you for correcting that. So the Supreme Court actually heard this case on the 7th, which kind of shocks me because, I mean, you know, I've got the radio on all day and I haven't heard a thing about this. I mean, is this case getting much media attention?
I mean, I think it's getting, you know, in the Huffington Post, we gave it a lot of play. You know, people are really interested in campaign finance right now ever since Citizens United. I mean, I think that that case really shocked a lot of people. I mean, for a lot of people, I think they didn't even know that corporations had these personhood rights before Citizens United. And hearing that, oh, well, corporations have a First Amendment right as, you know, persons to give unlimited campaign contributions to independent organizations sort of outraged people, whether you're, you know, a Democrat or a Republican or whatever your political belief is. It just sounds crazy.
Right. So since you were in the courtroom, what really stood out for you in terms of the questions the justices asked?
I mean, I think that this case really hinges on Chief Justice Roberts and where he stands on this. You already have people like Scalia, Thomas, and Kennedy who are highly skeptical of any campaign contribution limit or campaign finance law at all. And then you have, you know, the four liberal justices who, you know, mostly support campaign finance laws, even if they are not as, you know, maximalist in their support as previously liberal justices like Stevens. And then you have people like Roberts and a little bit Alito, although I don't think that he is as much of a swing vote as Roberts is on this. And, you know, Roberts was trying to balance this First Amendment question, which he agreed that these limits do place a First Amendment burden on, you know, a donor who wants to give to, you know, a 19th or a 20th candidate, like one or two candidates more above where the current limit would allow them to give. But he also raised this concern about the possibility of a politician soliciting a large check without the aggregate limits. And this was the main argument made by the government's counsel, the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, who basically said that, you know, if we get rid of these aggregate limits, there's the opportunity for a candidate to create what's called a joint fundraising committee, which is sort of like a accounting vehicle for a campaign that was used by Barack Obama and Mitt Romney in the 2012 election to collect a large contribution that then gets distributed to other committees. So without the aggregate limits, any of them, a politician could set up one of these joint fundraising committees and accept it a maximum check if they connect to every other candidate within their political party and every political party committee up to about $3.5 million.
Wow.
So, I mean, under, you know, the McCain-Feingold law, it banned politicians from accepting these large soft money million-dollar donations. And the Supreme Court upheld that, stating that, you know, that is part of the government's, you know, legitimate purpose in preventing corruption or the appearance of corruption, especially this quid pro quo corruption that the court seems to only recognize as the only kind of corruption right now. They sort of reject the idea that gratitude or influence is a actual form of corruption. And so I think that that is where the case hinges. And it looks to me like, you know, a possibility which Rick Hasen, election law professor out in California, has said is that it looks like Roberts might strike down the aggregate limit just to candidates, but not to political parties and political action committees, because the political party committees is really what sort of would allow you to jack up these joint fundraising committees and also circumvent the normal base contribution limits. And that's something that we've already seen. I mean, in Nevada, when Harry Reid's son, Rory Reid, ran for governor, he set up a system of 91 state political action committees that then transferred all of that money back into his campaign. Mitt Romney's presidential committee created a joint fundraising committee that linked to four non-competitive state party committees. So Idaho, Massachusetts, Vermont, Oklahoma, these things have nothing to do with the election. They're not competitive at all. But they were used to collect these maximum $10,000 contributions and then shift them all around to the swing state parties. And parties are allowed to make unlimited contributions to each other. So this basically eliminated their need to worry about the normal contribution limits that a donor would have to give to, say, the Florida Republican Party or the Ohio Republican Party.
And Lee, you have a piece called The Hidden Danger in this case, and you write about three conservative legal nonprofits filing amicus briefs in support of McCutcheon. What are they hoping for?
Well, the Roberts Court, as it's kind of well demonstrated now, has made a project out of chiseling away from the campaign finance system. Citizens United is certainly the most famous case, but there are many others. Wisconsin Right to Life, his attacks on public financing. And here we are with McCutcheon. And if you look at the kind of history of this, and if you're a conservative legal strategist and you're looking at this, and several instances, the most famous of which being Citizens United, the Roberts Court has gone beyond the issues at hand and made very broad rulings. With Citizens United, of course, that case began as a campaign or as a advertisement for a movie that then kind of metastasized into a broad ruling about removing removing limits on corporate and union spending and independent expenditures across the board. So what several conservative legal foundations have done in this case, as they did in Citizens United, they filed these friend of the court briefs, these amicus briefs, asking the court to move beyond just the aggregate campaign finance issue at hand and take another hammer at the campaign finance system in general. So in particular, one group is called the Institute for Justice. And what they're arguing in their brief is that the Roberts Court should not just do away with aggregate caps. They should do away with this legal standard known as the appearance of corruption. So the reason that we have aggregate caps or caps in general to candidates is a seminal case, Buckley v. Falejo, in 1976. And when the court came down and justified limits in terms of campaign donations, they said that in limiting that, the government has a obligation to prevent both quid pro quo corruption, you know, giving a bunch of money to a candidate for an exact kind of promise or favor, but also diminishing the appearance of corruption, because when you have, you know, this is coming out of the Watergate era, when you have lawmakers soliciting these 6, 7, maybe even 8-figure contributions, it undermines faith in government. It undermines the system in government because it creates an inherent conflict of interest. So what the Institute for Justice, this conservative legal group that filed a friend of the court brief, on McCutcheon said, well, not only should you invalidate the aggregate caps, you should, the justices should weaken the appearance of corruption standard, which in their view is unconstitutional. And if that goes, if in the decision that comes down in McCutcheon in a few months somehow weakens this standard that's been used for 30 years, what we could see is future challenges to a whole host of different good government laws. So if you look in federal court the last couple of years, the way that lobbying disclosure laws, conflict of interest laws, even gifts between lobbyists and lawmakers, contributions between lobbyists and lawmakers, the way they've been justified in federal court is citing this standard, the appearance of corruption standard that was kind of codified in Buckley v. Falejo. So they're kind of taking the long view, these conservative legal strategists. Now, will the Roberts Court actually adopt these views? Who knows? From reading the transcript, and you know, Paul can speak more authoritatively on this because he's been following this very closely and attended the actual oral arguments. But from looking at the transcript, it doesn't look like the justices are moving in this direction. That being said, many of these conservative legal groups that have filed briefs in the past, they're attempting to influence at least the thinking of the justices, and it's still a possibility that they could move in their direction.
That is Lee Fang, a reporter with The Nation. He covers money and politics. Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with The Huffington Post, also covering these issues. And we're talking about the Supreme Court case that was actually heard on Tuesday that would allow wealthy donors to pour even more money into political campaigns. And if you have any questions or comments about this, I mean, there's been so much attention on the government shutdown. Did you know that this happened? And I mean, what does this mean? I mean, when you look at the 2012 election, which cost $7 billion, Obama and Romney spent $3.2 billion, but $7 billion just on one election. I mean, it's hard to believe, Lee, that even more money could be poured into these campaigns.
Well, that's right. And you see a lot of what's going on the Hill right now. There are lobbyists that are hoping to game the situation You're seeing campaign advertisements or campaign-style advertisements already being aired in what folks think will be pivotal Senate seats next year. So the campaign for which usually midterm elections, these off-year elections, are a little bit more sleepy, less expensive races. But we're already seeing big money flowing into the midterms that are going to happen next year. We're already seeing senators kind of posture and figure out how they're going to get reelected and how they're going to raise these big amounts of money that are becoming more and more necessary to be reelected. And it's an unfortunate scenario, but for the media, you have to connect the money and politics angle. A lot of what's going on in the government shutdown will square with how folks are reelected. And if we continue down this road of removing campaign finance limits, the problem will only get worse.
Yeah, I mean, what does this mean for media coverage? Because we've done so many shows about this over the years, and reporters, you know, say that it's really hard to follow the money because the disclosure laws are so lax. So what does this mean for, I mean, even what you all described today, I bet a lot of people were having a hard time kind of following it just because there are so many loopholes. And what does this mean for the future of media coverage of money in politics?
I mean, I think that there are a number of things at work here around why it's hard to cover money in politics as a journalist and why it's hard to follow it as a reader. I mean, it is, a lot of it is highly legalistic and complicated, and it's, you know, it takes a lot of work to try to explain that to a lay reader about, you know, what all of this actually means. Like, who wants to read a legal brief about what a joint fundraising committee is? It sounds really boring. But it, you know, these things are actually important about how wealthy people in this country try to influence our government. You know, I'd say other challenges that reporters have is just the increasing speed of getting news out and the pressure to post something every day, to get something on Twitter rather than to spend time on a deep investigation that I think a lot of us face. And, you know, to get like a really good story on money and politics does take a lot of time, and you have to go through a lot of documents and really try to, you know, follow how money is changing hands. You know, it also requires some kind of knowledge of, you know, computer technology and computer language if you really want to speed that process up. And I think that a lot of news organizations are investing in more in people who can do that.
And you mentioned elections. A lot of people don't know that there is an election on November 5th. In San Francisco, we're voting on four local propositions. Early voting has already begun. So you might want to do some homework on that and then check in your area to see if there's a local election. But we are voting on November 5th. And we have a caller. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. We're talking about money in politics and the Supreme Court case that was heard on Tuesday. A ruling is expected sometime in June. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi, Rose. In the case of the organizations that we are trying to interpret who have support, large money support for so-called Christian right-wing, et cetera, organizations, we're just kind of looking for a calculus here. How much, when, say, your food stamps run out or your social services are clipped back, which were already meager, or there's a delay in your support money from Social Security or from another organization, and the volunteers step up, somebody steps up. Are the organizations that are going, let's see, what do we call them, Christian Lifeline organizations going to step up and fill the gap and make up the difference when people's food stamps run short?
You mean the ones that are funneling millions of dollars into political campaigns?
Yeah, I mean, what is the connection between these organizations, the ones that are, on the one hand, the Christian Pantry organization, and on the other hand, the unlimited right wing, it's too convenient, maybe too patent glib to call it right wing or conservative. It's just some kind of a power grab. What's the linkage?
Yeah, thank you. Lee, do you want to take that?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question because I haven't seen at least a very visible debate within the Christian community on this because, you, on one hand, you have a lot of Christian organizations that have stepped in to play a very pivotal role in various communities, sometimes with government support, sometimes with complete, you know, charitable support from their members, and they help people every day. And they're being affected directly by the shutdown because they're seeing a greater demand, and in some cases they're seeing a cutoff in funds from the government, which they work with. On the other hand, you have many of these highly ideological, highly political Christian organizations like the Family Research Council, which is mentioned in that big New York Times article we talked about at the top of the hour, that have played a huge role in this shutdown. And, you know, if you talk to their leaders like Tony Perkins, they say we don't need the government. We can rely completely on private organizations like charitable organizations. And we're seeing that kind of demand play out across the country, and we simply don't have the charitable organizations that can replace the government. Unfortunately, the media isn't kind of focusing, with huge exceptions like the Huffington Post, but you know, the mainstream and corporate media hasn't really focused on this grand experiment that we're going on. We're rolling back essential services, and we aren't seeing the kind of private charitable organizations step up and fill that gap.
Right. And then, well, and if they do, I mean, how sustainable is this? We're becoming, you know, so many organizations rely on charity, and, you know, they have to have these lavish parties and ask for money. But how sustainable is that?
Well, sure. Well, if you look at an organization like the Family Research Council, very religious, very, you know, very vocal with their demands. Look at their budgets. You know, they don't have the best disclosure, but they do file an annual 990 tax disclosure that shows kind of the top line numbers. They spend their money on attack ads. They spend their money on highly compensated political operatives. They're the ones demanding the shutdown that have orchestrated at least one aspect of the shutdown. And they're the ones saying that private organizations will step up and provide for the poor, provide for low-income individuals that most need this support, but they don't do they don't actually do it themselves, right? They say, okay, well, someone else will. We're a Christian organization, but we only play in politics. We don't actually do the things that we talk about.
Yeah, and do these reporters who have access to them or bring them on CNN on a regular basis ask them this question?
I was just watching Tony Perkins on CNN this morning, and they did not.
Yeah, no, So where is this going with the government shutdown? You're both in D.C. The president met with Republicans yesterday, and John Boehner was leading almost every newscast with some plan that he apparently has. But where is this going? Lee? Or Paul? Go ahead.
I mean, I think a lot of people just don't really know where it's going. I mean, from the reporting that I can follow, you know, it seems like the White House is actually talking to House Republicans now. I don't think that the White House wants to, like, give any concessions, especially the kinds of insane requests that the Republicans are asking for to sort of end, you know, the president's signature policy of his entire presidency, or to delay it for a year so that then we can do this again right before the midterm elections. Mm. So, you know, I'm not really sure what they can get that will make it okay for them from their base, from these outside groups like, you know, the Koch brothers or Jim DeMint and the Heritage Foundation to be able to say, okay, we got something, don't primary us.
Well, we'll definitely continue following this. Paul Blumenthal is a reporter with the Huffington Post covering money and influence in politics. Lee Fang is a reporting fellow at The Nation. He's author of The Machine, a field guide to the resurgent right. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the value of online comment sections on news and information sites. YouTube is imposing stricter moderation. Popular Science has dropped commenting altogether. So should comment sections be curated op-ed spaces or open free-for-alls? Where do we draw the line between moderation and censorship? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.